appreciate the opportunity to be here with you and see and hear all of you. And I'm really excited to learn that Climate Caucus is embarking on some work in the area that I'm speaking to today.
Recording in progress.
And I'm gonna share my screen now. The idea is to have some discussion, so I'll be popping in and out of screen share. Hopefully that's not too disruptive. But we do want to have like a good amount of discussion. And Alex, I'll look to you to keep us on track time-wise so that we don't go over. Everyone see my screen now?
Yep.
Okay, excellent. I'm just going to go into full screen mode. Hopefully that works. So, thanks again for having me. Just going to kick off by sharing a little bit about myself. So I feel like the topic that we're speaking about today, it's really important to think about where a person is coming from based on their own lived experiences and background. So I just wanted to share with you that I identify as being a racialized person. I'm from newcomer and settler family lines. I was born and raised in Toronto, but my family has settled in different periods of time in BC, Quebec, and Ontario. And I've worked in the nonprofit sector for just over 20 years, and I was a relative latecomer, I would say, to climate activism, but it's now become very personally and professionally all-encompassing, which I'm sure many of you can relate to. And I've been very fortunate enough to work for the Toronto Environmental Alliance, or T, as most people know us, since 2019. T itself, as a nonprofit organization, has been around Toronto for over 30 years. We work mostly on waste reduction and climate action policy and programs. We're very focused on City Hall here in Toronto, but through my work at T, I've also had the pleasure of working with other municipalities, specifically the cities of Vancouver and Calgary. And I would say this topic that we're speaking about is very emergent work in a lot of places. It's very, very timely as different municipalities both develop and launch different iterations of their climate strategy. So again, I'm really happy to know that Climate Caucus is working on this. And the last thing I'll just say is that this work for me has definitely been a learning journey. I'm not coming at this as any sort of definitive expert, but just happy to share what I've learned with you so far on this journey and really hope to hear from you as well. So I've broken our session today into three sort of broad areas, the who, the why, and the how. Alex,
sorry, yeah, the screen is still, is like it was showing and now it's gone black.
Oh dear. Do you want to, Alex, do you want to share your screen?
Yeah, I can.
Sorry about that. That's a new one, blackouts.
Yeah, it's done that, like, I've noticed that with a few
girls.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is that okay?
Yeah, so, you can move to the next. I don't know where it blacked out. Did you see this screen?
I don't think folks saw it, but you were talking about it, so maybe I'll give you a...
So we don't need to linger here too long. This is a picture of my family, and, so moving on to the who. The first part we'll talk about the who do we mean when we're speaking about engaging marginalized and vulnerable populations. So Alex, next slide, please. So I wanted to start off with some key concepts and definitions, and recognize that language is always evolving. And so, you know, what we speak about today, you know, when we meet again, say in 6 months or a year, we might be using different language, and I think that's okay. I've certainly sometimes been a little fearful that I'm not keeping up with certain concepts, and I always try to keep an open mind and try to sort of listen and learn from folks that may know more from me than me or have exposures to different forms and ways of saying things. So please, you know, feel free in our conversation to introduce ideas that I haven't brought forward here. I just want to start off by recognizing the distinct rights, histories, identities, and experiences of Indigenous peoples as rights holders. An Indigenous contact of mine was very kind enough some time ago to share with me that I shouldn't be using BIPOC language in our work. So you may be familiar with the term Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And they explained to me, not only can this mask the sort of unique histories, identities, and experiences of Indigenous people, but also the distinct responsibility that our governments have to Indigenous rights holders. So I don't use that language in our work anymore. I also want to acknowledge that I'm speaking from my personal experience, which has mostly been focused on working with racialized and newcomer people in climate engagement and with partners who work with people who have low incomes and people with disabilities. But I want to recognize that while some experiences are shared, how these experiences are had and, you know, the different communities and populations that reside where you are, you know, they each have their own experiences, and so I'm not using definitive examples here. I think the most important thing for all of us to recognize is that none of us are just one thing, and that, you know, identities are intersectional, and so too are experiences of marginalizations and systemic forms of oppression. And in Toronto, where I am, and I know in many parts of the country, housing precarity is a very important part of the climate conversation. And we know here in Toronto that people who experience precarious housing often have low incomes and are often racialized people. So that's an example of how these experiences may intersect. Other concepts I'm sure you've heard or are familiar with are most impacted communities or disproportionately impacted communities when we talk about the climate crisis. So those communities that often have contributed the least to the climate crisis but are most impacted by, for example, climate-related extreme weather. So this may be, you know, communities that don't have access to the resources to prepare for extreme weather or respond or move when a basement is flooded or go to another location when an apartment building gets really hot during an extreme heat event. We also talk about continuously excluded communities, and I think this concept is actually really important in the context of policy. We know historically there's been purposeful disenfranchisement and exclusion of communities, but to this day, people are continuously excluded because of the barriers they experience in public processes, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. And the last concept that I put up here, which you'll hear me use a lot, is equity owed communities. And I'm sure you've seen and heard different iterations of this term: equity deserving, equity seeking. I prefer to use equity owed because I think it shifts the responsibility to those of us who should be addressing the lack of equity and building more equitable societies, you know, especially government, rather than putting the onus on communities that are experiencing the absence of equity or the lack of equity themselves. And, you know, similarly, you know, when I speak about vulnerability, where I can, I like to insert the word made vulnerable, because sometimes taking vulnerability just as an isolated concept kind of just makes things appear that people are just vulnerable rather than, you know, addressing and acknowledging the systemic reasons why they are made vulnerable, particularly in the context of, you know, multiple factors leading to climate vulnerability. And so for today, what I'm going to focus on is centering the voices of equity owed people who are often excluded from climate policy and programs. And maybe I'll just pause there to see if anyone has anything to add. discussion in a moment, so maybe, Alex, I'll get you to move on to the next slide. So next, if it works, hopefully, we're going to watch a short 3 to 4 minute video. And this video is from some of our current work that we're doing with a partner called Community Resilience to Extreme Weather, or CREW. It's a volunteer-led organization. We're doing a project in St. Jamestown. And for those of you who might not be familiar with St. Jamestown, it's possibly the densest urban neighborhood in the country. There are about 18 high-rise buildings in quite a compacted space with a lot of newcomer and racialized tenants living in this community. So I just want to show you a video from that.
So just one sec while I like share that.
Alex, I appreciate you.
No worries. Lost the window that I was sharing. Sorry, I have too many windows, of course. This is what's going on right now. Okay, there we go.
I live in this neighborhood for more than 10 years, St. Jamestown. I've never got 15 floor. I am senior. It is very hard for me when the power is goes out and it's hot. The first thing, I feel hot. My body feels hot and I don't know how can I manage that. Elevator is not working. I cannot go by stairs. How can I go outside to get my food or my medicine? If there is emergency, I have to go to doctor. How can I go downstairs? But if I'm downstairs, how I can manage to come upstairs?
I've been in St. Jamestown for 10 years on floor 6. One thing that concerns me is the heat wave. During a heat wave, when our homes get hot and the AC is not working properly because not everybody has access to ACs, air conditioners, not having access to that, people want to go to somewhere where it's cool, where it's nice to stay in during the heat wave. The lobby is known as a cooling room, a cooling area type. It's not that convenient for everybody because it's a small space. No benches, no chairs, not everybody's gonna stand and wait there. Outside the areas, the green areas, the yard, backyard, front yard, it's not that convenient in our building because there's no shade, no chairs, no benches. It's hard to stay there for a long time during a heat wave. We can make more cooling rooms and more green spaces available for people. That is convenient, that is important for everybody.
My name is Hina and I'm 18 years old. I've been living in St. Jamestown for about 10 years now. So my main concern right now is communication. And I know our community is very diverse and like we're very culturally diverse. And that's a good thing. But when it comes to communication, there are things like language barriers, so like people not speaking the same language. And there's things like social tension where people don't really want to go into groups or like go talk to people because they're not the type. They want to stay alone. And this can cause a lot of problems, such as like times of emergencies, such as heat waves. They may not be able to get the information that's needed, they may not have the knowledge. And I believe that this can be fixed by having like creating such a group where people have the right to feel comfortable with each other, so they don't feel any stress or tension talking to people. And so bringing together, like bringing everyone together, can really help us communicate. Them better, have like better connections so that like we can be there for each other when times are hard.
I'm moving to this calendar, it's 34 years. The summertime is sometimes so hot. I never use the machine because I'm older, that makes me sick. Now I have my family are lonely because my grandchildren, before I raised them, my grandchildren. Now he's finished university. I still go outside with community center, do the happy because I'm feeling I'm not alone. So this is important.
Thanks for sharing that, Alex. And now just wanted to have a little bit of a conversation. Since Alex, you were sharing the video screen, I'm just going to put a couple discussion questions into the chat. So the discussion questions are, what struck you the most about these perspectives? What might be overlooked in a quote unquote typical municipal climate consultation? From perspectives like these.
I was going to say people who are physically unable to attend those which are often live and in-person open houses, like the woman speaking at the beginning of the challenge of getting up and down the elevator, getting food, groceries here. If you can't access those, you're not going to be able to access public meetings easily.
Yeah, that's right. And that's something I know in urban centers across the country, it's a major concern, right, when we have extreme weather events, power outage, or heat wave. How would we support, for example, seniors like her actually, if necessary, move to a cooling space or a cooling station or seek help? That's something that I know that there hasn't been adequate preparedness planning happening, but it's something I think a lot of, jurisdictions are struggling to come to terms with now. Other impressions or thoughts?
I'd like to put my two cents I noticed that all of the concerns that people were sharing, whether it was the communication or, shade or cool rooms or whatever, wasn't really about a bigger climate thing like reducing GHGs, which is often the sort of other kinds of conversations that would be had about sort of reducing the heat waves themselves, but more of adapting to what is actually happening. And I think that is something that we really need to work on as climate movers and shakers, because there's, the aspirational goals and, shooting for the moon, all that. But there's also sort of the emergency preparedness part of things, which I know a lot of emergency preparedness in British Columbia is not done in different languages. We had a detention pond built in our town, and that's to catch extra rainwater during the rainy season. And we're like, do we have to put French on this sign too? Not really. No one here speaks French, right? So there's definitely a sense that we could save money by reducing the number of letters on the sign, but it's communication is an afterthought. And I'd heard it said too about emergency preparedness, this is where I'll end it, is that it's a fraction of the pie until it's the whole pie, until your town is on fire or whatever. So I think that that's what I heard a lot of them saying, is that these things are happening to us, what can we do about it?
Absolutely. You touched on so many points that I hope we'll get to today. And I think your initial point's really important. Community members aren't necessarily seeing climate adaptation and mitigation as two sort of distinct areas. People are going to relate to what they're experiencing immediately. And I think there's an opportunity there sometimes to start with what we would call quote unquote adaptation or, resilience building, and, bring people in through that immediate pathway. Rather than thinking about them as, oh boy, we better get community members thinking about mitigation more, which has been, I've seen in a number of municipalities, very kind of siloed approach to engagement on those topics. Any other thoughts or impressions?
I think as well, there's an engagement, perhaps disconnect barrier to the community with such great suggestions. Simple things, the ability to pull your rooms in a very to have generators when elevators are out, or health preparedness checks on seniors, and then high rises, buildings. It's something.
so.
These are all things that are doable to connect with planners or with counselors. It may not be easy to share that knowledge.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, something that has come up when working with this community is really like, who is going to be doing the communicating about these things? You know, the city may have responsibility to provide certain things and make them happen, but really who's going to be on the front lines of doing the communicating and, you know, issues around loneliness and social isolation, but also sort of the opposite of that around the need to be part of a network, to be part of a community group, and how that can address both the loneliness and isolation, but also is like really important social infrastructure for reaching residents in these buildings. Maybe, Alex, we should move forward. So we'll move to the next section now, which is the why. Why is it important to engage these populations? And, you know, this is definitely some learning that I'm hoping to bring forward from our own experience working in this area. If you can move to the next slide, please, Alex. So one of the things that we learned over the last few years, and this may sound academic, but I don't think that it is the importance of thinking through a theory of change as to why do this work. So I'm just going to walk through one example here, and then we'll stop again and just have a few quick thoughts on it. So example number one, theory of change. If we raise awareness among equity-owned communities about climate change and climate action, we expect more people will use less energy and make their homes more energy efficient, take public transit and cycle more often, encourage other people in their communities to adopt these actions so that over time community GHG emissions decline and the municipality achieves its climate targets. So maybe Alexa, you can hop out of our screen share again. Just going to post another set of discussion questions for us here, which is, what do you think about this theory of change? Have you seen similar thinking applied in your jurisdiction? And in your view, will it work? Why or why not? Just stay in share screen mode for a little while, Alex. We can talk while we're in it. reactions. There's no wrong or right response to this. Just to get any sort of thoughts that this is what you're seeing, where you are, is it relatable, not relatable? Veronica has hands up.
It just seems like there's, it seems like you're putting quite a bit of onus on the community and not taking accountability for some of the barriers that are impacting them. Like, even this piece, like, I'm agreeing with Alex, essentially, but even this piece about, like, they just need to make their homes more energy efficient, as if they have their own property. Like, a lot of people are tenants, and sometimes I see in these climate action plans, there's focus on home ownership, and then just not a lot of discussion for people who own homes, but don't live in them. Like, how do we get renters, or people who rent their places out to actually care about how energy efficient their homes are if they're not living in it, they're not, you know, feeling it. Anyways, it just seems like there's a bit of detachment here, and it seems a bit tone deaf.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. There's no differentiation, and, you know, it doesn't go back to sort of, like, really understanding that we're talking about. Will, I think you had to.
Yeah, it just seems that the assumption underlying this whole thing is that all that is missing is information, and if people are given information, then everything else that will immediately flow from it, and that seems to ignore a number of the realities we've been speaking about, but the idea that we just need to provide people somehow that will resolve the entire issue. It's a very unidimensional, simplistic view in assuming everyone's empowered to just leap to action as soon as they find out it's a problem.
Yeah, that's right. And I will say, you know, I didn't take this from any one place specifically, but this has been, I would say, the underlying theory of change. It hasn't been written down in all places, in a lot of places, including where I am, and not just by municipalities, but by environmental organizations. You know, it's that whole information deficit approach to things. Maybe Alex, I'll get you to move on. So I just wanted to share some further thoughts, and I've found this helpful, and maybe you will as well. So I feel like part of unpacking the why, it's good to kind of look at, like, really what our motivations are for doing the things we do. And so two buckets that you may or may not find useful are the strategic and the moral/ethical. So strategic examples, we need more people taking actions that reduce GHGs and supporting climate policy. So that very much speaks to the theory of change that we just saw. It's not that it's necessarily wrong. That's one dimension. But another strategic one would be climate policy programs will be more relevant/effective if equity-owed people are engaged. So that kind of takes a different perspective. It's related to some of the comments you've made that actually, and this is a lot of our work is centered on this, like, we actually believe the policy and programs will be made better by bringing more voices in. And then if you look at sort of the moral ethical perspective, we should center the voices of people who contribute the least to and are impacted the most by climate disruption. So that really brings kind of a justice kind of approach. And then the last one I have on here as an example is equity owed people should have equitable access to climate decision making processes and resources. And, you know, there was that comment by, I think, Veronica and others who said, you know, like, if we have only programs that are focused on homeowners, you know, that's not equitable access to resources, for example. Next slide, please, Alex. So I've put up another theory of change just for us to walk through a second example, which is a slightly different approach. So if we work with members of equity-owned communities to develop a program to engage more residents in the municipality's climate strategy, we expect engagement programming will be more relevant to equity-owned communities and reach more residents, promote effective communication between equity-owned communities and local government so that more residents from equity-owned communities feel a sense of ownership over the climate strategy. Climate action programs address the experiences and priorities of equity-owned communities, and more residents access programs and resources. Over time, community GHG emissions decline and the municipality achieves its climate targets. Do you want to take us out of screen share mode, Alex? gonna pop the discussion questions in. So how does this theory of change compare to the previous one? How could this approach lead to a shift in how local governments engage equity-owned communities? And I know you just saw it for a flash. Just your impressions.
Maybe just one thing I'll offer, Rumi, is that I think the reaction from some would be that it'll be a lot more work, and it'll be a lot more expensive, and it will be slower. Doesn't mean it isn't good, but I think there'll be that to deal with in the process of doing it the right way.
Yes, I think that's a very astute observation. So there's a potential tension there, too, you know, when we're looking at what we perceive to be a very urgent situation with the time it might take to build something like this together. Other folks? Yep.
I think, too, looking at the previous question and this one, the engagement and some of the infrastructure I'm seeing in my community, that the challenge is the budget. And when you have decision makers who are looking at services and seeing things subsidized rather than benefiting the community and benefiting the community as a whole, seeing transit rather than seeing it as an investment, seeing it as subsidizing something, as paying for itself, the cycling infrastructure, that argument is fertile as well in our community. So we're not seeing the benefits because we're making investments. And I think that even the whole community and starting to see the potential, instead of engaging the same folks all the time, just make a huge difference. But I don't see our climate change action plan hasn't gone in that direction with that type of engagement. Again, it's the people who have to keep the pillar to come out. The computerized engagement, the digital engagement processes, and if you can't access that information, you're not there, it's not a voice. So I think it's partly investment in the services and investment in vulnerable communities to give them access to the conversation. So it's that intersection.
Kim, I think you covered like a lot of ground actually in your comments. You were cutting in and out just a tad for me, unfortunately. But just, you know, I think we could have a whole other hours of discussion around equitable climate finance and funding, which I know is just an immense challenge for so many municipalities. But I think, you know, one of your points is so important in that how these engagement processes are done. And then what gets prioritized as a result is so important. Like, I know where I am definitely thinking about in the context of scarce resourcing and still not wanting to step away from tackling that, but looking at what's more important, investing that money, for example, in personal EV charging or, you know, in public transit. Sometimes those tough decisions, you know, have to be made, and how we engage the public does impact on how our decision makers feel they can make those choices. So it is, I think, a very real challenge. Other thoughts? One thing I will just share from our experience is you know, these theories of change can be built together. They can be done with community partners. I think there's also a value in doing them internally, whether it's within, you know, local government teams or nonprofits, because I think it helps bring clarity to intention. So the first time we did this exercise, we did do it with some community partners. It wasn't like a full public exercise that T did, but it helped us understand what our true motivations were for doing this work and then how we would communicate those as we were building relationships. So I think, you know, these theories of change can evolve over time. They can become more expansive in terms of who you bring in. But I do think just from an internal perspective, they are valuable. They do help answer some questions.
So can I jump in with one other comment? something that I do hear from folks a lot is this, like, people will ask me if I think that doing, like, adaptation or, like, preparing for disasters is essentially giving in or giving up. And I do think a lot of the people that are in sort of more of, like, our position or sometimes the elected positions that are pushing really hard to do mitigation don't really want to, like focus on the adaptation thing. And a lot of the time, the equity owed communities, that's kind of what needs to happen first or what they're asking for. So I feel like maybe sometimes people just need to shift that perspective a little bit and be able to hear it and then understand how they can, like, go maybe in through that way to try and get some GHG reductions, but they may have to, like, prioritize something else for now.
I would love to just spin off of what you just said, Alex, because I think that it's kind of a both situation there, because, like, my community doesn't have transit. A lot of our older citizens have to leave the community because there's no, supports for them. There's no grocery store. There's, no pharmacy, blah, blah, blah. Some of the things that old lady was talking about in your video. And to invest in transit would mean that we could stay in our homes longer, which would also benefit, I see how, I guess it does for, like, the diehard climate activist feels like giving up, where we're like, oh, well, we're just gonna get ready to burn or something, But, I do see how, like, there's a huge disconnect between, like, having there be a line between adapting and mitigating. Like, I don't see any of the things that I do fitting into these tidy little boxes anymore. I see it as this, like, jam spreading out of the peanut butter sandwich, dripping down, and I really want there to be, for me, my work, which I'm specifically focused on, food insecurity. And food insecurity is often, oh, well, I can't get the vegetables that I want to buy because A, I'm too broke for buying them, and I don't have a car. So I need delivery to those food products. And those are one of the things that, like, I think the 12 rounds of vegetable delivery that we've done, 184 people didn't take separate cars. They had one, truck bringing all these things in. So it is a two birds and one stone situation. Thanks.
You might be the first person I've ever heard describe the mitigation adaptation nexus through a P&J analogy, but I love it. And I think, I think that's really important, and I think maybe it's a good segue to our next portion, which is the how. I'd say certainly it may be stating the obvious, but the why really, like, our why really impacts how we do the how, which is the engagement. And I will try to come back to your example because I think it's a really good one around food. So Alex, if you don't mind. So the big question around how do we meaningfully engage these populations? You can move to the next slide. So I wanted to start off by talking about some common barriers to engagement and supports. And I think these hold true across different areas, not just talking about climate policy specifically, but there's certainly ones that we've come up against in our work. And so, we see this desire of municipalities to engage equity-owed communities, but sometimes they just continue on with the same type of consultative processes without really understanding the barriers that have prevented these same communities from participating all along. And so I think it's important to have meaningful conversations. And again, these are often happening in the context of limited resources, but they still need to be had about what supports will actually enable participation and remove barriers, but also how they might be proportionate to what is being asked of residents from local government. So I've put up a few key things around things that we've found to be enabling. So for example, we're seeing, local government doing more focus group discussions with certain communities or certain segments they deem to be important of communities. And, sometimes these are quite time intensive. And so I think the first thing that often gets missed is, know, when folks are invited to something like this by local government, what Smith is often just asking them in advance, you know, what can government do in the context like of a workshop or a focus group discussion to meet their needs? That communication often just doesn't happen at all. There may be a slight concern about what may come back, but I think what comes back is often something that can be addressed. And so, you know, what we found typically is a big barrier is that engagement processes and consultations are not happening in a time and place that is viable for many community members. You know, particularly think of a single parent that's working two jobs. They might not be able to fit into a specific time slot at a particular municipal building. And I think one thing that pandemic times has given us is options to participate online and in person. So we're seeing more offerings around that, offering multiple time slots because work is very varied, household schedules are very varied. So having that degree of flexibility of having multiple slots at different times is something that can really make a difference, but is often overlooked. I think, you know, when municipalities are specifically asking for feedback and advice from different groups, they need to be prepared to provide material and financial support. So things like honoraria, because we see a lot of municipalities paying consultants fees, but when it comes to drawing on lived experience, that's not valued. I would say it's not valued the same, but that would be such an understatement. It's not valued at all sometimes in terms of financial support, like honoraria or other types of compensation. I think simple things like financially compensating, like the transit fare there and back, is often not there. Providing food when you're talking about a multi-hour engagement, or making sure that there's some form of on-site childcare, because folks, parents that are looking after children are often excluded from these processes just because that element is absent. And I think the key thing about meeting people where they are, you know, making sure if it's a particular community you want to talk to that it is close to home, it's in a perhaps a community center or a rec center or a faith-based building. We've seen a lot of success where even like engagement sessions are handed over to community organizations to run in their center, which has worked out really well when those relationships are established. And then I would say other types of support would be, folks have mentioned this on the call, you know, translation support, simultaneous translation support. This relates to the final point around making content accessible. Often content is not sent in advance, so people don't get time to digest it. We've all seen the very policy wonkish stuff with lots of jargon and terminology that comes out of some municipalities, and that's just hard for residents to understand. So making things like visual where possible, again, the translation support, making sure materials are screen reader friendly. These things may be done on some main websites, but they're not always done in terms of, you know, engagement or consultation materials. So that's quite critical. I'll ask you to go for it again, Alex. You know, I think this is a central feature, obviously, to what we've been talking about, which is building these deep relationships with trusted community representatives. You know, and they're so important in terms of bringing new voices in, like new to the municipality. They're not new to themselves, but new to the municipality, so that we don't see the same people again and again at these engagement processes. And you know, what I found is that like municipal staff doesn't always have, particularly, you know, environmental or climate division staff don't always have these relationships in place. And sometimes they need to be seeded through community organizations or community service agencies who may hold an initial forum together with the municipality, because it's not automatic that those relationships are going to be there right from the get-go. I think the important thing is to cultivate them as soon as possible rather than waiting for like a specific agenda or, you know, ask or task that government needs to get done. That doesn't always happen, but where possible, you know, committing the time for, you know, councillor staff or city staff to get to know community members, spend time together, and of course course, you know, transparency and being clear about the purpose for relationship building or collaboration, I think always goes a long way. I think something that we experienced when we were embarking on some of this community work is we were a little tentative and fearful about going out to community members and saying that we wanted to do work on climate change. And I think through the process, we became a lot more confident to just be clear about that, but to make space for community collaborators' goals in these processes and to really take their advice about how to link these to community priorities. Like, I've seen a lot of rigidity in municipal staff being like, well, we can't talk about food sovereignty or security because that's not a primary GHG reducing climate issue.
Yeah.
But we've heard repeatedly from community members that that's the entry point for the discussion. That's the discussion that people want to have. And then they talk about their relationship to growing and food, and then, you know, the climate themes start to come into that. So, you know, openness and being guided by community members that that might be the right entry point or the right priority with which to start the conversation. And also ensuring that when we're looking at some of these climate action initiatives or programs, that they're really building on community strengths and assets. We tend to operate, I'd say, mostly in this kind of like deficit or crisis model. And I feel like when you're bringing folks into these conversations for the first time, like, it's so demotivating. But that always seems to kind of like creep in there. So I think really trying to look at what can be built on, and that doesn't mean, you know, leaving aside the very serious situation that we're in, but just not bombarding people with it from the get-go. Next slide, please, Alex. And this is my, you know, my final two slides on the how. I think it's really important to demonstrate justice and equity in the process. So something that we found has been really beneficial is, where possible, co-designing engagement processes with community members. I think to co-design, that means everything from, you know, setting the agenda to creating the content together to delivering, you know, workshops together. Of course, this is really time intensive. So I think, again, acknowledging that there can be a tension there, you know, and sometimes engaging community members, it might just be in an advice capacity, but I think where possible, co-creating things together over the long run actually gets a better result. And we've had some success with sort of climate learning programs being developed in that way with local people. This definitely requires a willingness to share decision-making power and resources and be transparent about what those are. And we've seen that over time, you know, co-design processes can really build confidence and capacity in community members and prepares them better, I'd say, to lead climate initiatives in their communities when they go through these processes. It's very critical, of course, too, if you're working with community members to bring out, you know, climate engagement initiatives to other community members, again, that those goals be transparent and you're clear with community members, you know, how the feedback's going to be used and that it gets reported back. And, you know, we've seen that there can be different stages of report backs. It might just be an initial report from the workshop. You know, if there's a longer initiative that's under development, including a program or a strategy. But I think those initial steps are really important so people don't feel like they're just, you know, feeding things into a black hole, which has often happened with municipalities. and then lastly, again, I will highlight that we've seen great value in forums that are hosted by community members where policymakers are brought to the community, and those could be online forums but also in person, which kind of, in terms of realizing sort of justice in the process, kind of shifts the power dynamic. So rather than, you know, community members having to go to a municipal building and report to or depute at decision makers, bringing decision makers in to listen, maybe they get a small intro segment where they're able to speak to folks, or they speak at the end of the event, has really worked well for us. And, you know, it addresses some of the earlier points around meeting people where they are as well. And we'll just go into, if you don't mind, bring up the next slide. Something that we've seen work where we are is funding residents to lead engagement in their communities through municipal grants.
That's a good one.
Some of the residents that we co-created climate learning programs with have gone on to apply to government grants and get them, and are very successful in delivering engagement activities in their communities, including integrating them into non-climate activities. So, you know, a community park event or a cleanup, a cultural event, or a, you know, talent show, or, you know, a variety of things where you might not expect climate to feature. But I found that, like, these community members know best where to bring in climate engagement. Something that I think is important to let go of is sometimes these grants come with this requirement that community members need to demonstrate how this work is going to lead to mm-hmm. reducing GHGs over the long run. And to me, that isn't demonstrating justice in the process. If we go back to the original point that these communities have contributed the least to the climate crisis. So I think that's something that really just needs to be let go of completely with engagement activities, if the goal is really just engagement and bringing more folks in. And the other two things are, you know, structuring grants to really compensate residents' time. Sometimes I've seen with municipal grants, it's like only a very small proportion can go to compensating people's time, when really that is the bulk of the work. Mm-hmm. That's where the resourcing needs to happen. And, you know, resident leaders might choose to donate their, you know, honoraria or compensation to their community group, but I think it's always important that they have the option. And lastly, you know, the fact that the municipality can be involved in providing information and technical support as requested. So I've seen an example where a senior, you know, brought out workshops to other seniors and then invited staff to come and present on how they could access energy efficiency loans for their homes. And so that was a great example of how someone had come through our program, decided to lead these workshops, and then invited city staff to come in and provide the information that they wanted in a very specific way. Next up. Thanks. So I think we can see one another's faces now. I mean, there's a lot that can be said in this area, and I know that I went through it very quickly. We could probably spend hours speaking about it, but I do want to have our remaining time be a bit more of an exchange. So the question I
as a plan. So,
yeah, that's incredible.
engagement strategy.
Another good example that I always think of that I'm never sure if it's like how relevant it is, but I always think of it, so I'm going to share. Karen Tang, who's a counselor in Edmonton, and Andrew Knack together this year, I guess last year, did participatory budgeting in their community. So it wasn't a huge amount. I think they allocated like $25,000 altogether into their own communities and then they basically had certain numbers of grants, and they would do like presentations, and they had poster boards, and you could go in and vote on the ones that you wanted to have money towards, and they had a range of, I think, $2,000 to $5,000 grants. But it got a lot of people out, like of all ages, of all everything, and it also made the community really come together and then talk to each other about what they actually wanted or what they wanted the money to go towards. And so it ended up being like a really collaborative way of spending, like not even a huge amount of money, but for them to be able to see what the priorities were, and to get out, they did some like tree planting and things like that. And it was a huge success. So they're definitely going to do it again. That's a great example.
One thing I think is helpful to consider for grants is that where possible, if municipalities can start with smaller amounts but then increase them over time, so you build those relationships with folks that start with the micro grants, but then as they get more experience, the grant amounts can kind of increase and they're better positioned to do more impactful work. Because I think, yeah, like, you know, $2,500 or $5,000 can go pretty far for an engagement activity, but then in terms of, you know, escalating engagement or, you know, bringing in projects into a community doesn't go super far. So those kinds of models, where possible, can be really helpful.
Maybe share an example. We put together a new official community plan, and ended up taking place during COVID, and the public engagement piece was complicated to figure out, and we did an online town halls, which are helpful obviously for some people who have technological ability and sort of capacity, but also did neighborhood gatherings in individual communities with kind of a slow moving walking tour, and we had like kids bring drawings of how they'd like to see the community. We had elders talk about what used to be here 60 years ago when they were a child, what's worked well over the years, and in some ways the pandemic forced us to be much more creative than we planned on being. I think we were probably planning on renting a public hall and having a bunch of chairs set out, and whoever showed up got to say something, otherwise people weren't included. And it's a fairly conservative community, but these were really, I think, significant steps in terms of bringing, and also put together an advisory committee, which is youth, elders, indigenous folks, like just to work side by side with the planners in each step to make sure that there was a variety of voices, and certainly a start in the right direction, I'm hungry.
And how did you bring all of this together?
It eventually, between staff and consultants, was put together in just a large official community planning document, but it's certainly the council and our staff kind of reviewed it together and talked to the whole board.
That sounds really exciting, and you know, similar to the example that Kim gave. I guess the question to both of you is this captured or documented in a way that can be shared with other places? These planning, visioning and planning processes. That's great.
Yeah, it's online.